Listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and you're very welcome to join us for the next hour and a half as we go through our stories for this Thursday, the 19th of August 2010. We have an interview coming up with a man who we've tried to get on the show twice before to present some quite startling information on a scientific research area. It's all related to time travel, and I'll admit I'm a skeptic about the whole topic, and I haven't prepared for it in the way I usually do for interviews. The interview will be conducted mainly by Josh Jackson, who'll be joining us in about 15 minutes to pick that up. But it should be a very interesting listen, and enough to spark your imagination, and who knows, maybe the truth really is out there. Who knows? We'll find out. So please stand by and we'll bring you that very shortly. Meanwhile, we'll proceed with some news stories for today. Okay, I'm going to lead with a couple of Australian stories here. Firstly, wanted to talk about the ongoing questions around Julia Gillard's connection with the Israel lobby. And I have a story here published in the Sydney Morning Herald titled "Former Ambassadors Question Silence on the Excesses of Israel." A former Australian ambassador to Israel has accused the Prime Minister Julia Gillard of being silent on the excesses of Israel and questioned why her partner has been given a job by a prominent Israel lobbyist. In a letter to the Herald, Ross Burns, who served as an ambassador between 2001 and 2003, said Ms. Gillard had been remarkably taciturn on the excesses of Israeli actions in the past 2 years. Ms. Gillard has been part of the Australian delegation to the last two meetings of the Australia-Israel Leadership Forum, founded by the Melbourne property developer Albert Dayden. Mr. Dayden, just by coincidence, employs Ms. Gillard's partner, Tim Matheson, as a real estate salesman. Mr. Burns said yesterday that Ms. Gillard was at the forum's inaugural meeting in Israel last June, 6 months after the Israeli army invaded the Gaza Strip, killing more than 1,000 Palestinians. She was also the acting prime minister when the invasion took place and issued a statement at the time criticizing the Palestinian group Hamas for firing rockets, but did not condemn Israel for causing civilian casualties. And this is quite an extreme position, ladies and gentlemen, for our Prime Minister to take, when even the head of the inquiry, the Goldstone Report, who was a self-professed Zionist, had some very harsh criticisms for Israel. And even though that report itself has been criticised, it certainly identified that Israel had completely overstepped the mark and had committed acts which are tantamount to war crimes. So we have a leader of a government here which basically is taking an extreme pro-Israel position, more staunchly supportive of Israel than some of Israel's, you know, acknowledged Zionist supporters. And she is shacked up with the the right-hand man of one of Israel's major lobby groups in Australia. Okay, alarm bells should be ringing at this point. You know, big alarm bells and red flags should be raised. Hopefully you'll get this podcast before the election on Saturday. And, well, look, I'm not saying that the opposition leader is a great humanitarian man, and I'm quite sure that ties with Israel are quite strong there as well, and I'm quite sure that many of the issues that we have trouble with the Australian Labor Party are duplicated with the Liberal Party in a slightly different flavour. That's basically the situation, and I'm sure everyone listening to this show is tired of the whole topic because it's just so obvious. However, these type of gross examples of influence have to be highlighted, and this story was kind of buried. I only know because it was sent to me. I don't know if it was even published in the actual broadsheet. And it's buried in the Sydney Morning Herald website here. It has to be confronted. And, of course, this comes on the heels of threats to, well, not so much threats, but a statement by John Bolton, former US ambassador to the UN, that Israel is about to launch an attack against Iran. And I'll just bring that story up for you before we move on with some Australian material. Just loading that now. This is actually from the Jerusalem Post. Former US envoy to the UN, John Bolton, said Monday that if Israel wants to prevent Iran from acquiring a working nuclear plant, then a military strike must be launched against the Bushehr nuclear power facility within the next 8 days. The comments were made in an interview with the Fox Business Network. And I'll just play a clip here for you from that interview.
Iran is set to launch their first nuclear reactor next week with a lot of help from the Russians. The nuclear power plant at Bushehr has been under construction for decades, but it's the Russians who are helping them to build it, and they are now prepared to load it up with uranium. And with the reprocessing of the uranium from spent fuel rods, the Iranians could have everything they need to make nuclear weapons. So why did the Russians give Iranians what they need to become a nuclear nation? Joining us now, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Ambassador, great to see you. So what does this, first of all, tell you about our good friend, the Russians?
Well, you know, the Russians were under enormous pressure for years, not even to ship the uranium to Bushehr, by the Bush administration and Obama, and then by Obama not to allow the fuel rods to be inserted. And the fact that this is now happening, even after the fourth Security Council sanctions resolution, demonstrates that the Russians are, as they often do, playing both sides against the middle. And they're giving something Iran that's incredibly important here.
Well, we have no influence with the Russians. I feel comfortable in saying that. I mean, there's just no influence. I mean, they'll do what they want to do. They don't care at all what we have to say or think about it, right?
Well, I think this is a clear demonstration of that. And what is going to happen here in the next month or so as these fuel rods are inserted and the reactor is brought up to full power is that Iran will have achieved something that no other opponent of Israel, no other enemy of the United States really in the Middle East has, and that is a functioning nuclear reactor.
Well, I say, maybe I made a mistake. I said they really don't care if Iran gets a bomb. Maybe they do. Maybe the Russians want Iran to have a bomb in some kind of strange game that they're playing, geopolitical game.
Well, I think it's very much to Russia's interest not to have Iran get nuclear weapons.
I do
think
too.
That's,
but again,
that's
the way
obvious,
they think, again, the way, forgive me for interrupting, Ambassador, but the way they think, I mean, they play hardball, and maybe from their perspective, you know, it would balance things out in a certain way.
Well, the idea of being able to stick a thumb in America's eye always figures prominently in Moscow. So the fact is that the sensible view that this is not in Russia's interest does not prevail in Moscow, and that's why they're allowing this to go ahead. There's a cynical view that Russia knows that at some point maybe the United States, more likely Israel, isn't going to tolerate this going forward, and that they will use preemptive military force so that Russia wins on both sides. They sell this reactor to Iran, and then they get Israel to take it out. No downside to the Russians. They get to condemn Israel, but Iran doesn't get the bomb. That's a cynical view, but again, not unheard of.
Not unheard of, but that sounds, even for the Russians, that sounds like too many bank shots here. But the point is that we or Israel or whomever can't bomb these plants, this nuclear reactor, because it would send radiation flying in the air. It would affect thousands of people, Iranians. So in a way, they have almost checkmated us, the Iranians have. They now have a way of getting nuclear fuel that cannot be attacked because, for humanitarian reasons, it cannot be attacked. So they've got it, right?
Well, unless the Israelis move within the next 8 days, once those fuel rods are very close to the reactor, certainly once they're in the reactor, as you say, attacking it means a release of radiation, no question about it. So if Israel's going to do anything against Bushehr, it has to move in the next 8 days.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. This is incredibly inflammatory, incredibly dangerous, incredibly unbelievable talk. We know that John Bolton is an arch neoconservative, really the worst of the worst, a war criminal. Part of the cabal, part of the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, etc. The cabal of neoconservatives who we know were instrumental in 9/11 because it was part of their plan to have a catastrophic and catalyzing event to allow their military ambitions to come to full flower. And Iran has always been on the list, on the to-do list of the military-industrial complex to be whacked. So really serious situation there. And again, just relating that back to Ms. Gillard, we got problems here, folks. We got problems in this country because that makes us part of the axis of evil in the world, if you want to use a corny phrase. We will be part of the strike force if it is deployed against Iran. We will be implicated in that, and I'm sure we'll be involved in it in some way as a nation. So of great concern, and we'll keep our eye on that story for sure. Okay, just getting back with some Australian news. I just want to read you this peculiar story here from Tasmania. Peeping Tom Laws shield Mary. Police and family are going to extraordinary lengths to protect Danish Crown Princess Mary from the media during her Hobart visit. In stark contrast to previous relaxed visits, the privacy of Tasmania's most recognisable international celebrity is being tightly controlled. A police car was used to shake off the media pack yesterday morning, forcing news crews to wait at a roundabout as Princess Mary's car took off. Now, why am I even telling you this story? It just sounds like a tabloid story, does it not? Yeah, there's a reason. The police are using new privacy laws that were created to stop people taking inappropriate photographs of children in schoolyards. They're using these laws, which were basically anti-pedophile laws, to prevent the media from being able to approach a private celebrity in effect. It's not even an official state visit. It's just a private individual who happens to be quite well known, who is visiting the country, and the media are basically. And this is what we call color of law. We've talked about it on the show before, and Australia has such a maze of bizarre little laws and regulations that And we mentioned it last week in relation to the laws against photography, which are all tied up in council restrictions and commercialization and copyright, with a sprinkling of paranoia over the pedophile fears. And of course, it's never admitted that this has anything to do with suppressing freedom of speech. No. It's just a regulation here, a regulation there. But when the police want to basically do something or, stop you from doing something, they've got this amazing smorgasbord of minute, idiotic little laws and statutes that they can just whip out to basically justify shutting you down. And that's why I present to you that story and why we will just keep cataloguing it. And it's vast list. And I'd really like to actually have a page set up on Truth News somewhere so that we can go through the whole thing from beginning to end of just the number of freedom suppressing laws and bylaws that have been introduced into this country over the decades. So stand by for that.
Propaganda. Disinformation, misinformation, deception, deceit, spin, untruths, half-truths, lies. You know the truth. Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia. www.truthnews.com.au.
Welcome back to the show, and welcome, Josh Jackson.
G'day, Howard. How are you?
Real good. We've just been going through the latest nails in the coffin of freedom, and we've covered Julia Gillard, and we've covered John Bolton and the Israel lobby. And I just want to, just before we get our guest on for the night, I've got a few other stories I want to alert to our listeners. Important stuff for people who are involved in the 9/11 truth movement. We Are Change New York is putting on a massive event this year. And yeah. I would really, really love it if anyone out there who's a listener to this show is going to go, that you could be in touch with us and kind of be a correspondent, and we could interview you about what's going on over there. Because the event is called Our Lives Post 9/11. Join We Are Change for a four-day 9/11 Truth Conference and Charity event in New York City, September 9th to the 12th, 2010.
Huge.
Former CIA, FBI members of the House and Senate, a state governor, Parliament member and others converge with the people, with you, to discuss the fallacies of the official 9/11 report and the post 9/11 world. And we've got a bunch of photographs here of some of the people that are coming. We've got Cindy Sheehan, famous war activist, is going to be speaking there. We've got Cynthia McKinney, another, outstanding human rights advocate and ex-member of Congress, ex-presidential candidate. We've got Niels Harrit, of course, the outstanding scientist who's been absolutely instrumental in getting this this information up to the next level. We've got Annie Machon, very important British 9/11 whistleblower. George Galloway, again, a really important figure, George Galloway, who's actually an MP. He was actually originally a Labour MP in the UK government of Tony Blair, and he's now an independent. And, poor George Galloway gets just so much vilification from all aspects of media and government because he really, and it's great to see him involved in this. I'm really impressed because I didn't actually know that he was, in solidarity with the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, I don't know what you think, Josh, but looking at this list of people, the 9/11 truth movement is a highly prestigious movement now. I mean, that's the facts, folks. I mean, forget about the fact that the ABC won't cover it, okay? Forget that aside.
They're a small, tiny, pathetic fish that doesn't cover any real truths anymore. All they do is they're just a lapdog for politicians in Australia, and a few they throw out a few little truths here and there to make you think that they're actually on the ball, but they're just another corporate lapdog, really.
Yeah, a small player, you know, a small player on a big stage. So forget it. Just get in there, and again, if you're going over, and I really hope someone from Australia or someone that we know is going to be over there.
Truth movement.
Really important, yeah, because, you know, we've done our best to keep this up, and I'd be over there if I could. I'd be over there absolutely like a shot if I could. It's just not convenient for me, unfortunately. So that takes care of that.
Is this the same world for 911 Truth on that site?
Yeah, indeed.
Most important 9/11 Truth campaign ever.
It's also being advertised on World for 9/11 Truth. I'm looking at the We Are Change website here, but yes, it's also on their website. It's on a number of different websites. It's everyone's coming together on this. Okay, There's no factionalism, no nonsense.
It's not politically motivated. It's not. It's not religiously motivated, folks. This is true. Just. Truth seekers want to find out why the physics doesn't match up to notable Newtonian physics.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, I mean, the physics arguments are key and core to some of the forensic aspects of the truth movement. But, you know, the geopolitical aspects and the larger picture of...
I say political, it's not like, oh, this is to support, you know, the Greens or a certain political faction.
Indeed, but I always like to expand the sphere of 9/11 Truth so it doesn't sound like we're always talking about controlled demolition. Where even though the controlled demolition evidence is forensically important, it's only one tiny part of a giant web of evidence that we've got. And I would say flip it around as well and look at the absence of evidence that the US government has ever been able to present for their case that it was Osama bin Laden and the 19 hijackers. And I just want to advance
official conspiracy.
Yeah, indeed. Look at their lack of evidence. And I just want to quickly just remind people of the fact that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the only, you know, person who's ever supposedly confessed directly to planning the 9/11 attacks, he has not been charged.
Even though
he confessed,
he's just been tortured. That's all.
Yes. Well, and there was a big hoo-ha about him going on trial in New York, and then they had to cancel that. And I'm sure there's a whole lot of legal issues due to the fact that it was admitted that he was waterboarded 183 times. And so, you know, when you're talking about 9/11, always remember that there's all this other stuff. You don't always have to talk about the World Trade Center and the controlled demolition of the buildings. You can actually just start with the fact that, well, the only person that they've thought about charging was tortured, you know, was waterboarded 183 times. And if you're trying to talk about it to someone to convince them to just open their mind a little, that one statement should be enough. You know what I mean? That should be enough to say, hey, maybe we do need a new investigation.
There. Absolutely. But I still stand by the fact that the forensic evidence that Richard Gage and others alike, full-blown PhDs and heads of their industries have presented some amazing evidence, which is so important to the movement. And I think that, I mean, that for me really showed, because you can't fight science. You can't, because science is based on reason and evidence. And the evidence speaks so highly of itself. And the peer-reviewed papers that have been presented have stood unchallenged for multiple years now, and they're open to be challenged by any university or any other scientists, and they just stand unchallenged because, you know, if you're going to challenge these papers, then you're going to challenge physics in general.
Indeed, and what the detractors prefer to do is just snipe from the sidelines and make totally unsubstantiated attacks, like saying it's a vanity publication, it was red paint, it wasn't, you know, thermite. And, you know, of course, they won't write a paper on that. They won't support what they're saying with any kind of verifiable research. So, yeah, forget it. I mean, look at the facts. Go with the facts. The facts lead to inside job. Now, I think we're going to have to break. We've got David Lewis Anderson, time travel
Anderson, yes.
expert coming on. momentarily. So just stand with us and we will bring this amazing interview to you. Truth News, Radio Australia. going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Well, folks, it's our pleasure to introduce Dr. David Lewis Anderson from the Anderson Institute. Dr. Anderson has been working a long time with time technology and time manipulation in physics. Dr. Anderson, are you there?
I am here, Josh. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it is such a pleasure to be here with you, Josh, and Harewood on Truth News Radio Australia. I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to speak with your audience.
Fantastic. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what's your background and how you came to playing with time and the physics of time?
Well, how I came about to playing with the physics of time was by accident, but my background real quickly is I do hold degrees in engineering, physics, and philosophy. I operate today in an organization called the Anderson Institute, which is the second generation of a previous organization called the Time Technology Research Center that was based on Long Island, New York in the United States. That was founded after many years where I worked as a scientist for Air Force Systems Command for the United States Air Force. While I was working for them, I was very involved as a scientist in doing space-based navigation systems and high-speed space vehicle models. And during my work with the United States Air Force, I discovered some very interesting relationships with regard to time, space, and energy that sparked a passion. And for the last 30 years, I've only been focused on research and studying the nature of time.
Wow. So when you talk about the nature of time, how do you go about even, you know, A, I guess the mathematics are kind of crazy, but B, you know, developing mechanisms to manipulate time? And is that even
Time is a fascinating subject, Josh. You know, the one thing, it's a very difficult concept to grasp sometimes, mainly because the simple premise that as people, we do not see our universe the way it is. We see the universe the way we are. We perceive our universe through a very limited senses that don't perceive everything around us. And also, those senses are gated by our mind's belief systems. And this struggle to understand time has been a fascinating quest. Many of us take it for granted. But if you really look at it, we've had human society has struggled with for millennia in understanding time. Plato first thought treated time metaphorically as the moving image of eternity. The great philosopher Aristotle defined it as a number of measure of motion. Plotinus described it as the productive life of the soul. And then we had a philosopher, St. Augustine, who discussed time as an illusionary product of our mind, which, interesting enough, really holds true in physics today. And I challenge your listeners, if they think they understand the nature of time, to do St. Augustine's basic question and answer. If you're walking down the street or you speak with a friend today, ask your friend if they know what time is, and they'll say yes. Then ask them to explain it to you in words, and they'll be completely at a loss for words. It's a very interesting exercise, but it's a very deep and sharp insight into the fact that we've been struggling as a human society to understand time and still don't understand it today.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, you know, I'd naively say, well, it's the sun going around the earth and my perception of it. But then also, you know, sometimes you wake up and the day just seems to cruise along really fast and sometimes ridiculously slow. And what's your research behind that sort of, you know, personalized time?
Well, from a scientific standpoint, we certainly understand that time is not a constant, and it's possible to speed up and slow down time, even move back into the past. But one of the things that you touched on, Josh, is how we perceive time. It doesn't matter whether we're looking at millennia or microseconds. We perceive time each differently. where it's really nothing more than a fleeting moment through which the future passes to become the past. So if you look at it that way, the past and the future do not exist. The present has no duration. So how do we measure something that has no duration? And the belief is truly that time really is an artificial construct that's measured in the mind. And it's not an event that is measured, but instead the impression that it leaves on the mind. The mind simply just expects the future, which becomes the present. The mind attends to it, and then it becomes the past, which the mind remembers. And we each perceive things quite differently as far as our perceived durations of time, which is completely a little bit more of a philosophical issue than a physics issue, but it is how we, when we look at the universe again and the true nature of time, it's difficult to see because we all do perceive it differently. And it's a product of our biological and cultural evolutions.
Dr. Anderson, if I might just interject, I'm just looking at your website here. Now, it says on the front page of the website, imagine traveling in time, some process that would let you go backward in time to witness the events that changed history, or into the future to see if mankind survives, and then to return to the present with the knowledge of what will happen tomorrow. The process is intriguing, even mind-boggling, but the science is more real than imagined. Now, and looking at your website, I just have to say it has a kind of a science fiction-y kind of look to it. It has a kind of a Star Trek look to it, and I'm just trying to get my head into a space where I can actually say that this is kind of engage with it as something factual rather than something on a fantasy level. And this is where I'm struggling with it. But again, I mean, can you tell me that you are really seriously working on technology for traveling in time?
I think I can go better than that, Harwood. I can tell you that this movement in terms of time control technology research is actually not just underway at the Anderson Institute, but organizations around the world. And let me see if I can answer that question in about 60 seconds or so. First, we're seeing incredible changes in the acceleration of capabilities in controlling time. If you look at the situation around the world today for human society, there have been attempts at time control funded by government research since as early as the 1940s. There have been multiple technologies and different types of approaches. What's really happened in the last 15 years, 20 years perhaps, is that the technologies are becoming more widely applied and much more powerful. We actually see five major countries, not small countries, but major countries with significant government-sponsored R&D investment, heavily invested in time control technology development. The problem with that is that, and that's the point I do want to emphasize on the show, is that the technological capabilities have really exceeded the capacity for human society's moral reasoning. The technologies are used without understanding consequences. But for a lot of your listeners who might be asking the question, well, what is the fundamental technology behind time control? And frankly, just for your listeners, let me break it down real quickly. There's two types of time control technologies. If you look at it, they all can be put into two categories. Those that are based on Einstein's special theory of relativity. We all know this, is that if, for example, if an astronaut were to travel out to a distant star and return 20 years later, she would find out, say if she was traveling quite fast, she'd find out that 20 years she was gone, perhaps more than 200 years might have passed on the Earth. She had hence, in 20 years, traveled 200 years into the future. We know this. This has been reproven over and over again, that very fast speeds or accelerations relative to each other can dilate time. That's very fascinating, and that will be very valuable to human society in the future. But the type of technology that's getting the most play today is technology that uses either quantum tunneling or fields of closed time like curves. And essentially, for your listeners, there are actually 10 technologies today that are proven within the laws of our mathematics and physics to allow the control of time. About four of those are technologically feasible today, and three of them are being exercised in laboratories in different countries around the world.
That's amazing. I mean, it really blows my mind.
Well, I have to say I'm very skeptical, folks. So I hear your words, and I you know, if it were true, I'd certainly say it's amazing, but I remain unconvinced.
Well, actually, I would encourage you, while you have the website open, to take a look at the Time Control Technologies tab. And what you'll see there are 10 different technologies. About three of them are theoretical. The other seven are not. But let's run down a few of them real quick for your listeners. Let's talk about quantum tunneling. These experiments, this is essentially a technology where an evanescent wave coupling effect is used, where signals can be actually transmitted faster than the speed of light, essentially backwards in time. The Moscow Aviation Institute in Russia has done this. China actually just set a world record last month in the ability to exercise quantum entanglement as far as the distance that they could do it. That received a lot of news. So essentially, quantum tunneling is fascinating. It's even worse been done here locally in the United States. Princeton University, actually, for your listeners who wonder what quantum tunneling is, I'll give the example of the experiment in Princeton University. The U.S. government funded it, and essentially a signal was injected into a 10-centimeter-long cesium chamber. And what happens in quantum tunneling, essentially, what happened was, is that the signal actually finished leaving the chamber before it finished entering. It was traveling faster than the speed of light backwards in time. And quantum tunneling is a very interesting technology for sending information faster than the speed of light backwards in time, but not matter. To transmit matter back and forth in time, you need to use a technology that is a relativistic-based technology or something that uses closed time-like curves.
So when you have people sent matter back in time or forward?
Well, actually, interesting enough, there are several different ways to send matter backwards in time. And maybe I hate to do this, but just real quickly, essentially, there's a very important term for your listeners who want to understand time control technology. Look it up on the internet. You'll find a lot of sources, or on our website, closed time-like curves. Essentially, what this is, a German mathematician, Kurt Gödel, in the 1940s, demonstrated that it was possible within the laws of our math and physics to send information backwards in time, essentially looping back on itself in a closed time-like curve at speeds slower than the speed of light. Now, this was a radical new concept, but in the 1960s, it was expanded further by a physicist, an American physicist, Frank Tipler, and today it's the fundamental basis of all the technology being used. Today, we see Japan has a very wonderful laboratory dedicated to time control technology just north of Kyoto City. In the United States, we have several locations. Russia was active, slowed down. But the most exciting work today, you asked, Josh, where time control technology is exercised on matter, both would be in the United States and in India. The scale of India's operation actually is 10 times larger than the rest of the world's combined.
Wow.
That's how dedicated they are to this area of research.
Why do you think that is?
I get asked that question a lot. We actually, India is a partner. We work with their DRDO, which is their Defense Research and Development Organization. But why do I believe that? I think for two reasons. It goes back to the opening comment that you led me into, Josh, is the fact that we don't see our universe the way it is. We see the universe the way we are. We have trouble understanding that time, we can move through time as easy as space. If you look at the cultural evolution in India, the fundamental premise of their religion is that the world is a dynamic web of information and energy, and that everything and everybody in it is connected. And it doesn't matter whether it's further away than is possible to be connected by the laws of math and physics. So their cultural beliefs and their religious beliefs are quite a factor. The second factor is the political system in India. If you really study it closely, what you'll see is that the presidents of India and the leaders are elected based upon their scientific promiscuity, not their political popularity. So you'll see that the leaders in India typically achieve their positions with a strong career and understanding and an emphasis on science. So those would be my personal opinions.
I mean, it's my mind is so boggled by it because, A, you know, growing up as a Western guy with a watch and time is linear and it's an arrow pointing in one direction and here I go again, wake up, do work. I feel it's such science fiction because things like the paradox of going back in time the old time paradox of killing your father and then not being able to travel back in time to kill him, so you didn't actually go back in time to kill him in the first place. So these sort of things really throw my mind.
Just on that point, can we just pause there and can you actually address that for us?
Absolutely.
Dr. Anderson?
The grandfather paradox. Say I was to travel backwards in time and kill my grandfather. Well, my grandfather then was no longer born, so I could not exist. So my father was never born. I was never born. So I couldn't have gone back in time. So now my grandfather's alive. Now that he's alive again,
exactly.
I can go back in time. But if I kill him, then I won't be alive. So this loop. Basically, what we call that are try to label paradoxes actually are places where our rational minds bump into their own limitations. And Harewood, let me go after this one more time for your listeners.
Sure.
I'd like to make an analogy of the way not just our senses work, and our human mind, how they work together. Let's take the example of the old television set. The sky was filled with waves of information and energy. And if your listeners can picture right now in front of them a television set sitting on the table in front of them, they would reach up and they'd turn a tuner, a little knob moving them through the channels or the stations. And essentially, they would tune in to be able to perceive then a specific part of that web of information energy. And the human mind is no different. The universe really is a dynamic web of information and energy. Space and time are linked. It is possible within the laws of our math and physics to move through both, but the human mind is the barrier here. Our human mind is like a tuner. As we try to look at the scientific makeup of our universe and reality, and we try to look at perceiving that, we're limited first by our senses. Our senses are a very limited tuner. There's an unlimited number of channels flying through the universe that make up our reality, but we can only perceive a small part. And I'd like to hit that home.
Sorry to interject there. It's a lot of ancient philosophers have always said that throughout history. Especially Indian and other old textbooks that you read, it's always, you know, the reality isn't real and what you create, your mind is creating reality or perceiving a certain fragment of reality.
Yeah, maybe a lot of people say our focus is our reality, but this is very true. If you really take a look at what's coming out of the new physics, not just in time control technology, but take a look at what's coming out of the particle accelerators and super colliders, what is science showing us today? Science is showing us that it truly is we're living in a dynamic web of information and energy, and what's coming out of the new science has more in common with the ancient beliefs 2 millennia ago of Buddhism, Hinduism, and Taoism than it does with classical physics of 30 years ago. But for your listeners, one last point. If you don't think time is a function of your cultural evolution, again, how we perceive time is a function of both our biological evolution, limited senses and mind's belief systems, but it's also a function of cultural evolution. I'll give two examples just within the continents of North America and South America. In the language of the Navajo Indians and Hopi Indian tribes of North America, they have no verb tenses that ever talk about the future or past. As a matter of fact, in their history, they never talk about the temporal quality of an event, when it happened. They only talk about the quality of that. It's a totally foreign concept. In the Piraha tribe in South America, in Brazil, they have no concept of time whatsoever. In the Asian cultures, they view time as a circle. In the Western cultures of, say, North America, we view time as being linear. In some cultures, time doesn't exist. So how we perceive time is a cultural evolution consideration.
That's interesting. And have you done actual physical experiments with the paradox that you were talking about earlier?
Well, actually, interesting enough, it's one of our most well-known experiments in the United States with the paradox of the grandfather paradox. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, actually, we did. We had a young intern who was working with us at the Anderson Institute, and we did an experiment. We did a lot of early experiments in the 1990s with plant seedlings, and it still makes up a big part of our work today. And she told us one time that the genetic signature of the plant that came back that we had put inside a time warp field chamber actually did not match the reference set that we had. And she suggested that the plant seedling in the time warp field chamber where we accelerate and slow down time didn't change, but it was the construct of reality around us. And it was actually true. And we invented this experiment. It's called Brothers and Sisters. It's a big part of our work today. And what we do is we use generations of plant seedlings. And what we do is we put a plant seedling inside a chamber. We basically slow down or regress time. We trigger an event that kills let's call it the grandfather of that seedling. And then we bring that seedling back forward in time, along with a record of what its DNA footprint was. And what we found out was absolutely amazing, is that the process of sending that object or that plant seedling back in time and triggering that change actually changed the construct of reality outside of the field. And what happened when it came back forward in time is that its brothers and sisters, the genetic footprint that we had in the laboratory far away from the experiment, no longer matched the DNA footprint of that plant. And it was an absolutely amazing insight. And it also points out to an amazing risk that anytime you exercise this technology, there's a risk. There are many risks associated with this. Along with the many benefits for human society, there are tremendous risks as well.
So you're saying when you did these experiments, my reality changed over in Australia?
I'm not saying that exactly. Actually, that's one of the challenges is that this technology is amazing. The range of technological possibilities are so enormous, Josh, is that the only limitations what we do with this would really be the results of our insufficient imagination. And one of the challenges is that the complex web of interdependencies of this technology and predicting what the results will be far outseed the capacity of human knowledge and its capacity today. And that's one of our concerns, is that the gap in the technological capability of time control technologies, again, that aren't just being used at the Anderson Institute but other locations, are difficult to predict what the outcome is. Yet we're using them without understanding those consequences. And that's one of the real ethical concerns we have about the technology today and what happens in the future.
So there is actually stuff getting sent back in time in machines. I'm sorry, but I mean, it's just so mind-boggling. What do these machines look like? What are the fields look like?
Well, it's a little bit different depending on where you are. I mentioned that some work was being done in Japan. Japan is working on quantum tunneling. They work on sending information forward and backwards in time. And what that really is it would be a laboratory setup where typically there's a chamber of different types of geometrical designs, typically containing a substance. Cesium is very popular. And essentially, signals are injected into the chamber, and they leave the chamber. So essentially what they're building, what all these not radio signals, signals of not quite that high frequency that are being sent in. But the goal that they're trying to achieve is to send information faster and faster, further backwards in time, and eventually to be able to use that for practical applications. For example, there's a lot of unfortunately, people don't look at the technology just for the benefit of human society. Many people look at it for weaponization. I know there's a lot of military organizations that would like to have real-time feedback to be able to actually sense information back, say, 10 minutes from the future on the battlefield to determine how actions that are taken will affect the outcome of, say, the battle at hand. So that's what's happening in Japan.
To interrupt there, but on the militarization side of things, I mean, how are you able to talk about this stuff, A, and B, why, if you are able to talk about this stuff, how come it's not more mainstream when something, some amazing thing gets discovered, it's usually it usually hits the internet pretty fast and explodes all over Dig and.
Yeah, actually, I think if you look to the internet and you do a little more work, what you'll see is pretty amazing. In the 60s and 70s, we got involved in the late 70s, and through the 80s, we were doing a lot of building. In the 90s, we set up a lot of our first two generations of Time Warp field generators, and in the last 10 years, we've really been refining that. And that's kind of the course for the whole world. A lot of this has been the capabilities of the technologies have always been there. Since as early as the 1960s, these technologies have been out there, paid for, and thank you very much. The taxpayers of the world that are giving money to their governments, believe it or not, your governments are paying for this. And if you do your research, what you'll find out is if you look closely at government funding, you will find many public experiments as well as many that are not disclosed or sequestered somewhere deep in the government budgets.
So, Dr. Anderson, is the Anderson Institute a private institute then? Is that how come you're able to talk about it more?
Yeah, we're privately held organization. We do have both government funding and private organizations. We do partner with the Indian government and the Japanese government in our work. They have very real projects going on. I've walked through their facilities many times, and we have a lot of exciting work, very different in each location. But this, going back to your point for your listeners, is if you really look, you'll see an explosion of information. And that's what we're really seeing now, Josh, is the scientific community is really concerned about what's happening with the time control technology. We're talking about technology that has the way to redefine not only our world, but our very definition of reality and ourselves in ways that are difficult to comprehend. And the scientific community is split. Actually, most of the scientists now that I work with who do this full-time, who work in time control technology research full-time, are clamoring for disclosure. Now, some governments are very hesitant. India is very hesitant to disclose. Japan is stepping forward now. In the United States, we see many scientists stepping forward. At Princeton, at the University of Connecticut, at the Anderson Institute, there's still some activities at S4 in the United States that are kept quite closed. We have a very public effort in South Korea that just opened up. So this technology is coming of age, but also the risks that come with it are coming of age along with the opportunities.
As this sort of technology progresses, as the science progresses, what happens, what are the risks, I guess?
Well, I always like to balance that, Josh. So is it okay if I talk about some of the good, some of the pros and I talk about the risks?
Yeah,
absolutely. So if you look at, there are many scientists. There's a lot of politics behind this. You know, there are so many barriers to disclosure. You know, and you asked the question before. We literally could do a two-hour show on barriers to disclosure, why the governments aren't showing this technology and making it more visible. It's coming now. It's in so many places it can't be hidden. But they're in the groups that are working on this, they see many opportunities for good. For example, in medical applications, India has a complete department dedicated to building medical equipment. For example, they're building chambers that allow the acceleration of time rates inside of the chamber for research. There are many areas in the areas of disease research and other areas where experiments take quite a long amount of time for cultures to develop and so on. They're actually building chambers that can be used to accelerate those experimental results. Another the most exciting thing they're doing is something right out of science fiction in the state of Maharashtra in India at their facility there. They're actually building stasis field chambers. These are actually chambers where you lay down in, and essentially time is almost brought to a complete stop. So essentially what it allows you to do, if a human body has incurred an injury, it actually literally allows them to slow down the rate of time to prevent any further damage while they prepare for a treatment or a cure to that. And by the way, this is one of the first products we believe that will become publicly available, and it will come out of India. They're so far ahead of this on this. But, you know, some of the other pros, you know, how about if musicians or scholars of today could be inspired by our counterparts, not just from the past, but from the future? What about viewing and recording history? We have a lot of producers who come to us and ask us about advice for movies, how to make the technology more real. And, you know, we talk about the possibility and we joke about it. We could record history and bring it back, not just for learning, but for including it. What if we could view the real life of the dinosaurs in a documentary instead of viewing simulations? The only problem is the producers agree that probably the simulations are more exciting than real life that we see in the computer animations of today. But there are other good things.
We could avoid disaster.
Dr. Anderson, I just have to take a short break. And I just want to take a quick break and come back. Just got a couple more questions I'd like to ask. If we can just stand by.
Okay.
Thanks. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back to Truth News. Tonight we're interviewing Dr. David Lewis Anderson, inventor, I assume inventor, maybe I'm wrong there, but certainly a proponent of a technology that allows things, including bits of perhaps seedlings or perhaps even objects or perhaps even you and me, to travel in time. Now, look, I've just got some questions here. First of all, I'd just like to say I don't feel that you addressed the question of the time paradox at all, and I don't feel satisfied with what you said, because all you said was that there was a cultural paradigm. And, well, cultural paradigm, I mean, the paradox is still there. It hasn't been resolved for me.
Okay, so let me try to state it a little bit differently and use a basic analogy. Then I'll give your listeners a couple references that they can look up that are very easily publicly available on it. First, the concept of time. Moving through time within the laws of our math and physics is as possible as moving through space. Okay, we've known that since the early 1900s. Early 1900s is when relativity was first proposed, but we've known it since the early 1920s when the first proof came out that time is mutable and can be changed. Interesting enough as well, there is a very interesting book. It's called Space-Time Physics, and I'd challenge your readers to take a look at it. It's by Edwin Taylor and John Archibald Wheeler, two former colleagues of mine. And basically what they proposed a radical experiment in there. It's called something in physics called the invariance of the space-time interval. But here's what it is for your listeners. Look at your wristwatch and change what you're looking at in seconds to meters. If you were to do that, just hypothetically, just accept it, and hypothetically change what you see in your wristwatch from seconds to meters and use the speed of light as a conversion factor, what you'll find is that the complex physics of time and space-time physics and time control technology boils down to basic algebra. And there's a book on this dedicated to it. It's called Space-Time Physics, very simple title. And in this analogy, and coming out of this as well, you talk about the paradoxes again. And let me give another example for your listeners. Moving through time and space, let's imagine you walked out in front of your home today and you had a flower bed in your front yard. If you were to walk across it and back again, that would not amaze you. But as you did that, you would actually destroy some life, you might disturb some seedlings that will create new life, and then you return back to that point in space. You could even, instead of moving north and south, move east and west. You could even jump up and down a little bit. These are the dimensions that our biological and cultural evolution help us perceive. Time is a little bit different. We know that time is mutable. This has been a proven fact since the eclipses proved special relativity back in the 1920s. But what's very interesting about time and the grandfather paradox is how our perceptions see it. Literally, moving through time is like moving through space. If I were to walk across that flower bed and walk back again, or if I was to move through time and back again, I literally changed the construct of reality, the same as moving through space would destroy parts of that. And we talked about, you know, a little bit about the brothers and sisters experiment. And this is one of the things that's not a popular view, but I'll tell you right now is that all of our colleagues in India and Japan agree is that the popular concept in movies of parallel universes simply isn't true. A lot of people believe that if you go backward in time and kill your grandfather, what happens is the universe with your grandfather alive goes in one direction and a parallel universe branches off. We see that now as completely as a fallacy evidence behind it.
I've heard that version. And I must say it is more appealing intellectually because it doesn't result in a paradox.
Yeah, because it doesn't contradict with our belief systems. And we like to think time is, in our cultures, in Australia and North America, we like to think that time is linear and it moves forward like an arrow and it protects us. And what is the function of our mind's belief system? Let's go back to scientific references. What is the function of the human mind? It's very simple, one sentence, to rationalize what our senses perceive with our mind's belief system. So the whole mind's belief system and everything we use to interpret is based upon that cultural evolution and the limitations of the senses. And the best physicists I know, and we spend a lot of time traveling here with lecturing with young physics students at universities, and the first thing we teach them, they always ask, what does it take to be successful in the field? And the first thing we tell them is one sentence. We don't recognize the fact that we don't see our universe the way it is. We see the universe the way we are. We shrink all the magic in our world to the size of our daily routines, our material possessions, and only those physical things that we can touch and feel. And in science, while we know that's not true, the human mind still works the same way and perceives, and human beings act the same way. So I think it's an inward question that people have to ask themselves as well as they look at this subject.
Well, you know, the thing is, for me, the science really has to explain stuff more than my cultural understanding of time. Because, you know, if I culturally understood that two magnets were magical things and that's all I ever knew, I wouldn't really understand why these two rocks are pushing up against each other. But it's science that comes along and says, well, this, and this is the reason behind that. And then I have to evolve my thinking. And yes. I want to really understand how, when you do send something like a seedling back in time, how do you know it's actually back in time? How do you measure that? Is it just purely mathematical or?
Well, in a time warp field chamber, in different experiments, we call our device is a time warp field reactor, is what we call a time warp field generator. And in this situation, we actually use everything from reference instrumentation to plant, both inside and outside of the fields. We use plant seedlings. We use different types of living organisms that have very predictable germination or culture or cultural development time. And there are many different ways that it's demonstrated from that standpoint. But literally, in a time warp field, for example, you can literally modulate the field. Just as simple as turning the volume up and down on your radio, though not quite as simple, obviously, and not as inexpensive as your radio. Literally, speed up the rate of time inside the field, the chamber field, versus what happens outside. And you can actually see that and measure that through instrumentation.
What does that look like, Dr. Anderson?
Well, it depends on which technology. If you're talking about ours, our time warp field generator, it's a very interesting device and system to see in operation. When we open a field, we use a chemical reagent inside a chamber, a high-powered laser array, and introduce a field into the chamber as we open up what we call a time warp field. As part of the opening of the field, we actually introduce a second rotating magnetic field that essentially during that process you see a lot of noise, a lot of light, then the field stabilizes, and then you have a boundary layer of the field, which is very noticeable, that has a little bit of a watery effect and a little bit of an opaqueness depending on on how you modulate the field. But essentially, once the field stabilizes, essentially then objects can be put inside the field, including reference instrumentation like very accurate clocks, and then the rate at a time can be accelerated or slowed down. And this is no different than the experiments we've done in space, the experiments we've done in aircraft around the Earth. The difference is, instead of using accelerations, relative accelerations to dilate time, we're using fields of closed time like curves to dilate time. And that's the basis of, for example, the science of using circulating light beams that has come out of the University of Connecticut. It's the basis of time warp fields, and it's the basis of a device or a technology called a Tipler cylinder as well in time control physics.
Oh, man. Is there any video of this? I mean, I'm a very visual person. You know, I'm a 3D animator by trade, and I'd love to see it, something, you know, like actually some of this warp field.
Well, interesting enough, for references for your listeners, I'd really encourage them, go look at two things on our website. Look at the time. First off, it's free. There's nothing, you know, no fees, no anything. It's an educational program. Click on the time control technologies and take a look at the different technologies, and you'll see all those 10 technologies are shown within the laws of our math and physics, a few theoretical, most of them proven, to be able to control time. So this is not, you know, it's not a lot of hype. It's not speculation. These are 10 solid technologies and a comparison of each that demonstrate this. With regards to videos, in the education tab, you'll see a number of free videos that you can download or view with regards to time, including some on time control technology. And also, we actually have a new documentary coming out that will be showing the first, let's call it, broadcast view of our experiments. We have shown video of our experiments in many face-to-face forms, and we do that today, but we have not made them available for broadcasting. And in this next documentary coming out in the coming months, you'll see the first broadcast views of time warp field generators in operation, as well as probably those from other countries.
Now, if I may just ask another question here at this point. I've got an article here which was written by Alfred Webray, who is a well-known proponent of extraterrestrial UFO kind of secret government involvement in type things. And he wrote an article in December of 2009 in which he talks about your appearance, that you emerged publicly in a two-hour interview on December 23, 2009. And I've just found that interview on Blog Talk Radio. And I'm just wanting to know if that's true, that you emerged publicly, that was quite recently. Now, how long has your website and your sort of public face been available, or you know, on the internet, etc.?
Since about 1978, and I can understand your question. In 1978 to 83, in the early 1980s is when I was working with the United States Air Force as a scientist. In the late 1980s, I stepped out and we formed the Time Technology Research Center, where we did most of our work. That later transformed into the Anderson Institute. We were in the public eye, including on some of the largest TV and radio shows around the world up until 2002, and we went dark. Okay, and it sounds very clandestine and very very dramatic.
Okay.
But essentially what happened is in 2002, we had built our third generation time warp field generator, and the results were absolutely phenomenal. We got a lot of press then, and then once we realized what we had and the risk, we had two problems, Harrowed. The first problem was that we realized we needed to have better security. And this is when we shut down the Time Technology Research Center on Long Island and we moved all of our assets to a more secure facility in New Mexico. That was the first challenge, is security. The second issue was we realized that we didn't have the competency to ensure that the technology be used for the betterment of human society. So we needed the security. But the third point would be is that we also needed resources that were unavailable. And this is when we began building a global network. And we spent probably from about 2003 until middle of last year actually establishing a global network, working with different ministries of science and technologies in different countries, setting up partnerships, building infrastructure, and then we decided to become public. We felt that the technology in 2002 had reached a point where it could no longer be in the public eye. We also had a lot of security incidents, including a bombing on our facility in New York at one time. So it got very serious, and we were very concerned about our employees. We came public, again, because not just the pros. You know, if you look at this technology, what a great opportunity. We can avoid disaster and suffering for human society. We could travel into the future to bring back cures to solve some of the diseases that are plaguing our planet. We could avoid natural disasters. But at the same time, we're talking about the potential risk of redefining history, of technology whose results include such a complex web of interdependencies that's beyond our human capacity to predict, but we continue to use them, and we're redefining basically the structure of reality. We're talking about risk of social unrest, global catastrophe, and I got to tell you, a lot of scientists predict that one of the great next events will be the world's first great time war, where time control technologies are used for nations to seek advantage over one another. And frankly, the technology has reached such a high power in 2002, in the late 1990s and to 2002, that we said it's enough. We really need to protect this better and have a little more wisdom applied to it. But I'd say by the time we reached middle of last year, we began to realize that the technology capacities in these other countries also had reached a high level, and now the only way to address this for the betterment of human society is full disclosure and transparency. And that's something that the Anderson Institute, by participating in shows like this, is asking. We want to see every government-funded initiative in every country of the world brought forward to see that transparency and disclosure. We want to see education and more information available. Harold, you asked the question, why is nobody aware of this? It's been going on. It's right there. It's there in the government records in different countries around the world. It's just we don't look for it. We do kind of get caught up in our daily routines and our material possessions, but this type of work has been going on. The issue is now we all need to take a little closer look at it.
For me, it's so amazing, Dr. Anderson. It's just phenomenal. And that you were talking about, finding cures for diseases and stuff, and new drugs and things. I mean, what would happen though if you just went forward and went forward in time, got a cure for something, and then had it? Would it never be actually worked upon and discovered in the first place, because it's just pops into existence almost? I mean, is that my rational mind just trying to think around what's going on? My brain just starts fogging up with steam when...
It is difficult because, again, the way the way we've been educated, the way we've been raised, the way we've evolved in so many ways, These are paradoxes, and there are many other examples of paradoxes in this field. But I would say yes, it really is a place where think about it. Let's give an example for those people who are naysayers, and let's talk about what you just said. You got to be able to see and touch something to prove that it's real. Well, we saw a very noble effort many hundred years ago. It was under the guise of the Cartesian duality, where science used to be treated as almost witchcraft in different parts of the world. And then a proposal was made that said that, wait a minute, science is just a different way of looking at a religious truth. This kept the scientists from being executed and sentenced as being heretics. But one of the problems that came with the scientific method, and this is a big part about what we're talking about in our upcoming documentary, is that it now only allows you to talk about things that you can touch and feel. The problem is there's a lot of things as living human beings that we cannot touch and feel. And an example would be, in the last couple hundred years, you've kind of seen a separation between spirituality and science. And what we're seeing now is the opposite. What's coming out of science are things that are magic. What do you mean that, you know, the concepts, the world is a dynamic web of information. Everything is connected. The speed of light is not a barrier. Everything that one person does affects everybody else, even if they're separated at great distances. That our notions of time and space are completely construed, that have nothing to do with our ability to sense, but the ability of science to come to a realization, unfortunately, that human society realized millennia ago. And in this example itself about the evolution of beliefs and spirituality and science, how they move through history on this planet, they separated and then they're coming back again, is a good example of some of the benefits and weakness of the spiritual method along with the scientific method. And this is a very very important subject. I hope that we can share with people. It helps them to understand the subject matter even better.
Dr. Anderson, can I just drop a paradox of my own into this? Because if, and this seems to be a self-validating thought experiment, if at some point in the future time travel is perfected, then it is reasonable to assume that people from the future will be traveling in time back into the past and into the present now, and that they will obviously already be with us now if at some point in the future time travel does get invented. So, in fact, the effects or, you know, manifestations of that would already be apparent. And, in fact, you yourself may be somebody that's come to us from the future, for all we know, and the fact that you suddenly emerged kind of hints at that. That's just a rhetorical comment, because I feel like we're in a really kind of slippery sort of, very, very dangerous waters here in terms of the credibility of Truth News Radio. And I just want to say thank you very much for coming on the show. We're going to have to wind it up pretty soon. Josh, please continue. I just want to say we're going to have to wind it up pretty soon. Please continue, Josh.
What's next for the Anderson Institute? I mean, this is such amazing stuff. What's coming up next for you guys?
If I could just real quick two answers. You know, Herod, I really appreciate your words, and we don't ask anybody for a blind faith in what we're saying, and we don't look for people to trust us without being critical. All we ask is people study and make an informed decision. Human society struggled so long to understand the nature of time, and great progress is being made. There are 10 technologies listed on our website. People can take those, research them, talk to physicists, and what you'll find out is absolutely they are solidly demonstrated to allow time control within our math and physics. All we're saying is that the technologies have been exercised outside of the public eye and some in the public eye that now have reached great capabilities. And that leads right into your question, Josh, what is next? Is that if human society is really going to realize benefit from this technology, four things have to happen. And this is what the Anderson Institute is driving in addition to our research, is that we have to demand full transparency and disclosure on the technology, and then we have to launch an educational initiative. We have to make information about this subject and the work being done available to everybody worldwide without exception. Then what we have to do is we have to develop a method, a forum, a committee, a World Time Council, some forum that becomes a moral compass that guides any further, not just use, but development of the technology. And finally, we have to monitor it. But if the technology really is going to benefit human society, this disclosure has to happen. And it is happening. Dr. Mallett has stepped forward from the University of Connecticut. Dr. Lejun Wang stepped forward from Princeton University. We're stepping forward.
Do we have references? Sorry, Dr. Anderson. Well, are there references for those academics you just referred to that we can put on our site?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Are they documented on your website? These individuals?
Yeah, As a matter of fact, if you take a look at those time control technology links, and a simple search will take you to all the different references, including the original funding, who funded the research, or who was the original author, as well as references some to peer review. And I have to tell you, there's some of the work there that does not have peer review, but that's the nature. Unfortunately, the governments and the leaders that control nations and private organizations don't disclose every aspect of their technology. But there is absolute proof for every one of the 10 technologies there that it's completely achievable within the laws of our math and physics. And I think that's where you're going at, Harrowood.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, obviously, if there are such people who've been working in the mainstream of science, I'd like to see what exactly they have said, and I'd like our listeners to be able to get access to that as well, yeah.
And your listeners will see a lot more becoming publicly available from many locations in the coming years.
Terrific.
Dr. Anderson, when you talk about time warp fields, are they measurable? So if something happened, like if some nations, you talked about time wars. I mean, this is a concept that's just so fantastical and scary. How can something like that be kept in check?
Well, there's two ways, through technology and through another method in which I'm not an expert. But as I mentioned to you, four steps, disclosure and transparency, education, a moral compass to guide the technology, and then monitoring. We actually have developed a technology that could be easily deployed in low orbit around the Earth. We call it a temporal tremor detector. It's like a seismic detector that you use for detect an earthquake, but essentially it can detect any time a technology that exercises space-time control is activated. It's not much different than the types of systems that are deployed for detecting nuclear activity.
Any of the 10? All 10? Would it detect all 10 of the...
I didn't understand the question, Josh. You broke up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. It would detect all 10 of the different types.
It's called a temporal tremor detector. We call it a TTD for short.
Uh-huh. Because, you mentioned that there's quantum tunneling and time...
I think I'm losing you. I hope not. And we're losing
that's okay,
here.
Folks. Look, we may be losing. Josh, are you still on board?
I'm here. I'm here now.
Yep, I am here.
And I'm still here.
Okay.
Good. There's the ambient warp drive, the all these quantum tunneling and stuff like that is on your site. Time warp fields. Does the detector detect all the 10 different methods of time manipulation?
Yes, that's correct. It detects all of them. I would say the detection of three of them are theoretical or are believed to be true because the technology are theoretical. For example, wormholes and cosmic strings haven't been demonstrated yet, even though we know mathematically and within physics they're possible. And the final way, again, I'm not an expert in this area, there are some people we'd like to label as human temporal tremor detectors. There seems to be that 2% of the population that has a gift, to be able to sense alterations in time. But that's a topic many people like to discuss. But unfortunately, it's not something we really have the credentials or the experience to talk about.
Wow. Well, Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for coming on the show and spreading this information. I'm speechless, honestly, to say. And we'd love to have you back on the show later if there's some big announcement or some growth in this science. I mean, this is really the edge of amazement.
Well, it's like I said, it's not just us. There are many organizations that are doing remarkable work, and the progress is just outstanding, but at the same time, risky.
Terrific, folks. Okay, well, we're going to have to call it a night. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson, for your contribution to the show. I'm still very skeptical, but we will put this on our show notes, everything you've told us tonight, and hopefully get some good feedback.
And if anyone else wants to find any more information, Dr. Anderson, is it just the Anderson Institute or your Facebook as well, I guess?
Yeah, they can. If anybody would like to follow up with questions, we're pleased to answer questions. Contact us via the website or via Facebook, and we'd be very pleased. You can find me on Facebook under David Lewis Anderson.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Anderson, and good night.
Thank you, Harrod and Josh. It's a
Cheers.
Pleasure. Good evening.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Well, there we have it. I hope you enjoy that. Something different from Truth News. Good night, Australia. Good night, world. Good night, all time zones, including future and past, since the time travelers are probably able to pick this show up and have a bit of a laugh.